to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we discuss the current state of American democracy, recognizing the risks it faces today, while still offering a glimmer of hope along the way. One goal of this show is to explain how government actually affects people, and that starts by knowing who is in government and what they do. Civic education must go beyond a simple understanding of checks and balances. It's about real people and real action. Many people can name the Kentucky governor, but what about Kentucky's lieutenant governor? Do you know what she does and how her work impacts your daily life? Do you know her main priorities? We are all about to find out. Our guest, Jacqueline Coleman, is the 58th lieutenant governor of Kentucky. Lieutenant Governor Coleman has served as a high school teacher, school administrator, and basketball coach. She was recently chosen to be the chair of the National Lieutenant Governors Association for 2026-2027. Lieutenant Governor Coleman, thank you for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start off with your role. What exactly does the Kentucky Lieutenant Governor do?
Well, the Kentucky Lieutenant Governor does whatever the governor needs them to do. It's the best way, I think, to describe that. Over the years, the way that we run has changed, and the jobs that we have changed. It used to be in Kentucky that we presided over the Senate. We no longer do that. And so I made sure that when Governor Beshear and I were having our conversations about potentially running together, that I would have a very active role in this administration, because that's something that I obviously wanted to do. My words to him were, if you want a wallflower, I'm not your girl. Mm-hmm. And to his credit, he said, if I wanted a wallflower, I wouldn't be talking to you. And so in a place where your role is not really defined in statute, but you are ultimately the architect of defining it, I thought that was a really good way to start off that working relationship.
So let's talk about how that all went down. Take us back to 2018. So Andy Beshear is the attorney general. He's looking at running for governor. He asks you to be his running mate. You're an assistant principal at a high school at the time. What was that all like?
This is a great story, and it's still unbelievable to me. So one day, then Attorney General Andy Beshear called. And that was not something that would have been out of the ordinary, because we knew each other before, and you know, we knew each other's parents and all of those types of things. It's small circles in Kentucky, you know. And he asked me if I wanted to grab a coffee sometime. And I said, sure. And then he called the next day and he asked the same question. And I was like thinking, what does he want? You know? And so the funny thing about this is it took us a minute to be able to schedule a time to sit down and talk. I had no idea what we were going to talk about because I had bus duty. And so I had to wait until the last bus left the parking lot to be able to leave and go have this meeting with him. So we sit down at a Panera in Louisville, and he starts, you know, talking about that he's going to run for governor and why he's running. And I still don't know why I'm there. And I just kind of was thinking, well, what does that have to do with me? And he said, well, the first decision I have to make is who I want my running mate to be. And my mouth dropped. And he said, is that not what you thought we were going to talk about today? And I said, no, Andy, I just left bus duty. Of course, I did not think that's what we were going to talk about today. So that's how this all started. And to this day, I say that has to be the only time that that conversation has started that way in the history of Kentucky.
Wow. Well, my wife's a school teacher and she often has bus duty at the end of the day. But so maybe we'll see if she gets a call someday.
That's right. Yeah.
So one important aspect of Kentucky's current politics is that you and Governor Beshear are both Democrats. Both houses of the legislature are controlled by supermajority Republican. How does that impact your work for the Commonwealth?
Well, you know, it shouldn't, because ultimately, I think we all run for office to serve and hopefully to do good. Unfortunately, so many issues have been really polarized, and partisanship obviously is at a probably, I would say, an all-time high. And so that makes things difficult sometimes. But I will say that the governor and I have really tried to, from the very beginning, really push out national politics, the culture war issues of the day, cable news, all that stuff that can be a distraction from the real important work. And so I think that's actually served us well in doing that. We've had a lot of opportunities to work across the aisle to get things done, things that people said could never be done, like medical marijuana is an example. Sports betting is another example. And I have had a great working relationship with Republicans who have worked in education or who are working in education now, because we see so many challenges in the same way just because of our life experiences. And so I think we've tried to when we were able to work across the aisle, but also I think it's important to talk about disagreeing in a responsible way, because you never want to burn a bridge that keeps somebody from coming back to the table. And so that's kind of been my goal, is that even when we can't agree, you know, I'll stand by my principles and you'll stand by yours. And we need to do it in a way that will allow us to come back together on issues that we do agree about.
And one of these issues is near and dear to my heart as a professor of election law and voting rights, is that Kentucky became a national story for good in the way in which we ran the 2020 election during COVID, and then in coming up with bipartisan voting reforms. So why do you think Kentucky was able to kind of buck the trend of extreme partisanship in voting rights and serve as a model for the nation at that time, at least?
We really work hard to make sure that everyone who has the right to vote is able to. And then we even took a look at the folks who had lost their right to vote, the nonviolent offenders specifically. And in our first week in office, the governor restored voting rights to nonviolent offenders in Kentucky. And, you know, this really shouldn't be a Republican or Democrat issue. It really should be the fact that we don't want to disenfranchise our own voters, especially because we don't have the best turnouts in elections always. And so when voter turnout is already so low, we want to make sure that anybody who has been disenfranchised, you know, gets that right back. And so that's really what we work to do, which is quite the opposite of what we're seeing in D.C. right now with the SAVE Act. I think it's been described as addressing a non-existent problem at the expense of the voter, which is really unfortunate.
And so what would you like to see Kentucky do now in terms of the right to vote? You mentioned re-enfranchising individuals convicted of a felony. I know there's a push in Frankfurt to create a state constitutional amendment on that issue. But what else would you like to see the state do with respect to voting rights?
Democracy is not a spectator sport. And we have a lot of people sitting on the sidelines. And so I know we talk a lot about registering new voters or returning voting rights to people who may have lost them. I would really like to see us focus on turning out voters in elections who should be participating already. And not in a partisan way, not just when it's election time and we, you know, put ads on television and try to get people to turn out to vote for one specific person or even ourselves, but, you know, a year-long campaign to really help to increase turnout and participation in elections from people who have the right but may not be exercising it.
So let's talk a little bit about education. You know, you were a teacher, an assistant principal, a basketball coach. So that probably gives you a unique perspective on the state's education issues. How did that experience inform your thoughts on public education?
I would say that the biggest difference for me is coming into this role as a lieutenant governor, having been a classroom teacher, is that I look at the challenges that we face very differently than folks who have never taught in a classroom before. Number one, it's education is the lens through which I see all of those challenges. And I also believe education is the solution to the vast majority of those challenges. But what I would say is when we look at the challenges that we face in Kentucky, So often we're looking at data and spreadsheets and line items. And what I can tell you is, as a teacher, I don't see it that way. You give me an issue and I can tell you the name of a kid in the family who has struggled with it. And so it's very personal to me. It's much more than numbers on a page. It's the story of kids and families that I've worked with over the years. And so it means more to me.
So when you travel the state, you talk to a lot of people, I'm sure. What voices do you think are least heard in Frankfort? And how do you try to elevate them?
You know, I honestly think that the voice of young people is not always heard. It's something that, as an educator, we talk a lot about student voice and student agency in the school and in the classroom. But the reality is that so many decisions that are being made here in the halls of Frankfort affect young people, and they're being legislated at, not brought in to be part of the conversation even, or part of the solutions. And so I actually launched the Student Mental Health Initiative, and it was completely student-led to tackle the issue of youth mental health that we've heard so many people talk about, but I continued to see adults talk to other adults about it and totally left our students and our young people out of the equation. And so just as a reference for why it's important to include young people in conversations that affect them, one of the results of that initiative was that we brought $40 million to Kentucky for school-based student mental health services. And again, this was a student-led initiative that I helped with. And so I think there's a lot to be said about elevating the voices of young people, especially in the policy arena, because those decisions are going to affect them today and much longer than it's going to affect the rest of us if they choose to stay in Kentucky. I would also throw into that category educators, and for the same reason that they are legislated at more than they are legislated with, and there are big decisions made about their retirements, about their pay, about their classroom environments and the resources that their classrooms get. And so often it's made without conferring with the people who are doing the work every day. I'm just a big proponent of, if you think something is enough of an issue that you want to pass a law about it, then you should probably include the people who are doing that work every day. I know that sounds like rocket science, but to some, but it's not.
We're speaking with Kentucky Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman. Education has been a common theme of our conversation. And so I'm curious about civic education in particular, something that I'm very passionate about. I wonder, could you tell us what you think the state of civics education currently is in Kentucky, and what should we do differently?
I could go on for a very long time about the importance of civic education, because I was a government teacher and a U.S. history teacher. And I believe in it so much because I became a social studies teacher because I wanted to help students understand how the government works and, more importantly, what to do when it doesn't work for you. And so what I would start with is by saying that we've got to move away from the teaching to the test idea for planning curriculum and classes. I think civics and government and community engagement even should be taught every single year that a student is in school. So it's kind of become a practice that students don't really even start to study social studies until third, fourth grade, which, you know, is a huge disservice to so many students. As a high school teacher, what I would love to see is two required civics courses in high school. One, as freshmen that come into the high school level, to focus on how local, state, and federal governments are designed to work. So just the structure and framework and how all that works. And then one, their senior year, that covers how to be a participant in your government. So you learned how it works. So now how can you participate? How can you get engaged in your community? How do you register to vote? You know, how can you, you know, petition for change, those types of things. So that would be in an ideal world, in my view, that we would have those two classes to help our students, number one, understand the makeup and structure, and then number two, understand how to become involved.
So I'm totally on board, but I'm curious how we navigate the politics of this. I mean, even improving civics education or increasing civics education has seemed to be political these days. What thoughts do you have about how we make that argument for, you know, the need for more and better civics education in our schools in the way that you've described?
Right. So I think this gives us a real opportunity here. And first, we have to make sure that our policymakers and our implementation, which would be at the classroom level, all agree that it's about teaching students how to think and not what to think. And so under the civics umbrella, you can teach communication skills, problem solving, critical thinking, how to collaborate and work with others. I mean, every skill that students can learn that are transferable across the different subject areas can be directly implemented through civics education. And so I think if we keep it focused on skills and also the belief that we're teaching students how to think and not what to think, potentially we could get there. But I also believe that it's important enough that adults should be able to put their differences aside to do what's best for kids.
What's been the most surprising thing you've learned as Lieutenant Governor?
I would have to say that as I travel the state, I am constantly amazed. I don't know if I'm surprised, but I'm amazed at the way that Kentuckians show up for each other. You know, so often we see the negative things on the news, and obviously, you know, what sells on TV isn't always reality. But through some really tough times in Kentucky, getting to see our healthcare workers shepherd us through a pandemic, getting to see our first responders save people's lives during tornadoes and floods, but also how community rallies around those disasters, natural or otherwise, but also to see how people on one side of the state can get involved and collect resources and donations and those types of things for people on the other side of the state that they've never even met. Those things are always heartwarming to me, and it reminds me why what we do is so important.
Yeah, how important is that to show up? I mean, I think that's been a constant theme of the governor and yours term is that, you know, we've had a lot of natural disasters in Kentucky, and yet people are showing up. Tell us a little bit more about the role of government in that aspect of dealing with a tragedy.
Yeah, I've always felt like the first most important thing that we can do is to show up in communities where we're needed, to be able to look people in the eye, to give them a hug, to reassure them that we know that they're there and that we see them and we see what is going on and we're going to help. I can't imagine having gone through some of the things that these folks have gone through in their lives with the tornadoes and loss of life and the, you know, all of those things. And then never laying eyes on someone who could actually help. I think I would feel very lost if that were me. And so I don't ever want anybody to feel that way. And so it's important for us to show up so that they can, that the people who are affected can see that their government is there. But I think it's also important for us to show up because as hard as it is, seeing it for yourself, watching what families are going through, creates this sense of empathy in you that you couldn't get otherwise. It makes it personal and it's hard. But I always remind myself that as hard as it is for me to look at and as hard as for me to watch and listen to, I get to go back home. And these people are really dealing with the hard things. But when you put yourself out there and you show up, you're really allowing yourself to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And I think that's when the best policy and the best response is made.
You know, we hear a lot of doom and gloom these days about democracy. I'm curious, are you optimistic about democracy?
Of course.
What makes you optimistic?
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. Again, education is the key to this, because the great thing about democracy is that we get the government we ask for. The scary thing about democracy is that we get the government that we ask for. Mm-hmm. And so increasing education again about what government's role is in your life, what it should be doing, and what you can do when it's not working for you is really important, I think, for voters to understand, for our citizens to understand. And so, again, that's losing faith in democracy is a real thing that people are experiencing right now. But I still believe education is the key to curing that.
So beyond voting, if you could tell every person in Kentucky they should do one thing to help sustain democracy, obviously we want people to show up to vote, but what's the other thing that people can do, a practical thing that someone can do to help sustain democracy in this moment?
I'm going to give you two things.
Fair enough.
Okay. The first thing is I would make sure that my elected officials knew who I was. From your school board members to city council members, mayors, judge executives, to your legislators, right? Making sure that people know who you are and know the things that you care about. Because once that relationship is built, then you can start to have other conversations. But if you haven't built it and you've never reached out to this person before, and the first thing that you do is come to them with a problem or something that you disagree with, it's going to make that conversation harder. And it's going to make that relationship rockier than it needed to be. Whereas if you just reach out to them and start off with a conversation, it'll get you much farther. Number one. Number two, I think you should have a conversation about a tough issue with someone that you don't agree with. When I say conversation, I don't mean on Facebook. I don't mean hiding behind a keyboard and arguing. I mean, sit down with somebody that you care about, who is a part of your life, and talk about something that you don't agree about. And do it in a way, again, that will allow you to respect each other, to find out where you're coming from, and to walk away with the ability to come back together again because you haven't burned a bridge. We've lost that. Civil discourse is a lost art, is what I always say. And so something as simple as having a conversation like that, I think, is good for democracy.
Jacqueline Coleman is the Lieutenant Governor of Kentucky. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Josh, in your conversation with Lieutenant Governor Coleman, you brought up civics education and you asked what sorts of reforms are needed. What did she come up with? What did she suggest we do?
You know, I was really interested in her views, given that she was a teacher, right? So She's been in the classroom. And, you know, one of the things she talked about is improving civics education and mandating more of it. You know, we so often focus on the subjects that we have statewide testing for, you know, math and reading, and those are obviously important. But just by the nature of the incentives of teachers needing to ensure their students are ready for those tests, often civics education goes by the wayside. And so I was encouraged by her view that we need to increase the amount of civic education throughout the curriculum and also reinvigorate our classrooms to be places where we're having these types of conversations.
What's your sense of the atmosphere we're in now? Do you see an increased interest in reforming civics education and bringing it back to the forefront?
There's actually competing, I think, interest going on right now. I do see a lot of positive movement to focus on civic education, but do so in a way that is not just about memorizing facts or memorizing, you know, checks and balances or the three branches of government, but engaging in what we call action civics, which is getting students to perform real-world problem solving, where they can see the impact of engaging in society. The flip side of that is there's been a push against this because it's being seen as partisan. Now, I personally think that is crazy, that civics education, when done in an action civics way, which just says, hey, here we can have students understand what it means to interact with politicians, interact with the policies, it should not be seen as partisan. Unfortunately, kind of everything is seen as partisan. So one thing we need to do is to continue to make the argument as to why civics education is not partisanship in disguise. It's really about creating an informed electorate.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond and Landon Palmer are our research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.